Welcome to Delmarva Public Radio's celebration of National Poetry Month, featuring literary biographies with Sue Ellen Thompson. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. In this series, Sue Ellen Thompson discusses the life and work of three eminent American poets, Robert Frost, Jane Kenyon, and Jack Gilbert. Today's lecture is the first in the series and is titled Robert Frost, Wild Man. Sue Ellen Thompson, a distinguished poet in her own right, has published 5 books of poetry, served as editor of the 2005 edition of the Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry, and is the recipient of numerous awards, including nomination for the Pulitzer Prize. Her poems have been read a number of times on National Public Radio's The Writer's Almanac. All 4 of the programs in this series are produced by Delmarva Public Radio with the cooperation of the Talbot County Free Library in Easton, Maryland, and the Talbot County Arts Council, which funded the original lecture series on which this program is based. All of the lectures were recorded in the Frederick Douglass Room of the Talbot County Free Library before a live audience. Robert Frost, Wild Man, focuses on the life of Frost following the death of his wife, Eleanor, in 1938. Frost is probably the best-known and best-loved poet in America, and when we think of him, we think of a gentle soul sitting by the fireside in his New England cottage, writing verse like The Road Not Taken, or Mending Wall. Poetry that touches our own gentle nature. Following the death of Eleanor, however, Frost was a man in conflict. To ease his guilt and his depression, he reached out for another man's wife. Sue Ellen's lecture is the story of Frost's relationship with that woman. And now, Sue Ellen Thompson and Robert Frost, Wild Man.
Those of us old enough to remember Robert Frost when he was alive tend to picture him at John F. Kennedy's inauguration in 1961, with his white hair flying in the bitter January wind, his scarf spilling out of the neck of his overcoat, and his voice faltering as he struggled to read the poem he had written for the occasion, in sunlight that was too bright and on a day that was too cold for a man of 86. But he recovered quickly, reciting another one of his poems from memory. This image of Frost as a modest, avuncular man who loved farming as much as writing poetry has undergone numerous corrections over the years, most notably by his official biographer, Lawrence Thompson, who spent so much time with his subject that his admiration eventually turned into dislike. In the years since his death in 1963, Frost has been criticized for many things, for keeping his wife in his shadow, for neglecting his children while traveling around the country giving lectures and poetry readings, and for being fiercely competitive and critical of other poets. But there was a period in his life, long after he'd become America's most widely known and respected poet, when, in his own words, he was wild. This was in 1938, the year after Frost won his 3rd Pulitzer Prize and became the best-selling American poet since Longfellow. His wife of more than 40 years, Eleanor, had died in March in Gainesville, Florida, where they had started spending part of every winter in the hope that it would help them avoid the colds and respiratory diseases from which they had both suffered in New England. They had been out looking at a house they were thinking about buying, and when they came back and started climbing the stairs to their second-floor apartment, Eleanor had a heart attack. She spent the next 2 days in bed, becoming so agitated whenever her husband entered the room that the doctor finally told him to stay away. She died without him at her side, and he never had a chance to say goodbye. What ensued was emotional and psychological pandemonium. Not only was he overwhelmed by grief at the loss of a woman he had known since high school, they were actually co-valedictorians of their class, but also by guilt. Eleanor had been under considerable physical stress throughout their married life, with 6 pregnancies and then a miscarriage at the age of 50. She had to deal with her husband's frequent periods of illness and depression. She had to move back and forth among New Hampshire, Vermont, Amherst, Massachusetts, and Ann Arbor, Michigan, as her husband jockeyed for plum teaching assignments. She had to endure the loss of 2 of their children, a son when he was a toddler, and an adult daughter in childbirth. And she had to put up with her husband's almost constant travel once he had made a name for himself. As Frost wrote to a friend, "I'm afraid I dragged her through pretty much of a life for one as frail as she. Too many children, too many habitations, too many vicissitudes, and a faith required that would have exhausted most women." Eleanor, a highly intelligent woman who must at some point have harbored ambitions of her own, instead spent her life as the wife of a famous American poet. The oldest Frost child, Leslie, compounded her father's feelings of guilt by blaming him for her mother's death. If he hadn't insisted that Leslie stay on the ground floor of the house in Florida so that his writing time wouldn't be disturbed by her children's footsteps overhead, Eleanor wouldn't have been climbing those stairs. Leslie accused him outright of putting his own career interests before his wife's welfare. And then, of course, there was the fact that Frost had never had the opportunity to apologize to Eleanor before she died. Although he had stood outside her door and eavesdropped on her conversations with her doctor, she never once called out for him. As he moved their things out of the Amherst house following Eleanor's death, Frost wrote to his friend Bernard DeVoto, a writer who was teaching at Harvard, "I don't know myself yet and won't for a long time, if ever I do. I am so quickened by what has happened that I can't touch my mind with a memory of any kind. I can't touch my skin anywhere with my finger, but it hurts. In such like condition, I spent all of yesterday packing deadly personal things in the desolated house on Sunset Avenue." Since 1921, Frost had been teaching at the Breadloaf School of English, which was held for 6 weeks every summer on Middlebury College's Mountain Campus in Ripton, Vermont. In 1926, Frost had also helped start the Breadloaf Writers' Conference, a haven for famous and would-be writers held during the last 2 weeks of August every year. So at least he had the summer at Breadloaf to look forward to during that bleak spring following Eleanor's death. The director of the Writers' Conference was Ted Morrison, and this is where the story gets interesting. Ted Morrison taught at Harvard during the academic year, and in 1936, while Eleanor Frost was still alive, he had invited Frost to deliver a series of lectures there. Ted's wife was Kay Morrison, an elegant, rather outspoken young woman who had actually met the poet when she was a senior at Bryn Mawr, and he gave a reading there. So when Frost arrived at Harvard to deliver his first lecture 16 years later, Ted and Kay were only too happy to hold a reception for him. Having lived in rural areas and among farming people for much of his life, Frost was quite taken with the sophisticated Kay, despite the more than 20 years between them. The summer after Eleanor's death, Kay Morrison stopped in at Frost's house in South Shaftesbury, Vermont, to see how he was doing. She saw immediately that he was deeply depressed, and she invited him to spend some time with her and her children. Crazed with grief and desperate to escape the empty house that held so many memories, Frost took her up on the invitation. Although very few details of that visit have come to light, It seems that Frost wasted no time falling in love with her. He was 64, and she was not quite 40, the wife of a Harvard professor and the mother of two young children. According to Jay Perini, the author of A Biography of Frost, the relationship was consummated during that visit, and Frost impetuously asked Kay to leave her husband and marry him. The fact that his wife had just died 5 months ago and that Kay's husband was his boss at the Breadloaf Writers Conference doesn't seem to have slowed him down in the least. Kay refused, and an interesting arrangement developed both in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Frost got an apartment shortly after Eleanor's death, and in Vermont, where he bought the Homer Noble Farm about a mile from the Breadloaf campus so that Ted and Kay Morrison could live in the main house during the summer and he could stay in a cabin on the property, writing his poems while teaching at Breadloaf. Kay agreed to act as his secretary and agent. She typed up his manuscripts, arranged his lecture schedule, screened his visitors, and basically organized his life. Ted Morrison must have realized at some point that the arrangement was more than a business one, but he respected Frost's genius and chose to let a lot of things pass unnoticed. That first summer following Eleanor's death, Frost was quick to acknowledge his gratitude. In a letter addressed to both Morrisons, he said, "You two rescued me from a very dangerous self when you had the idea of keeping me for the whole session at Breadloaf. I am still infinitely restless, but I came away from you as good as saved." Lawrence Thompson, the biographer who had become way too involved in Frost's life over the years, saw what was going on and actually wrote a letter to Kay advising her never to leave her husband. It was around this time that the relationship between Frost and Thompson really began to deteriorate. We can only imagine the heated discussions that must have taken place as the two men tried to agree on how the biography should handle the relationship with Kay. Frost wanted it to be portrayed honorably, but not characterized as platonic. Thompson, who was worried that Frost would make Kay his literary executor, which would give her the power to throw all sorts of obstacles in his path, wanted Frost's written permission to tell the story of his love affair. Frost finally decided that Thompson should write the official biography without mentioning any specifics about his relationship with Kay. He could then write a separate volume focusing on this that would be left in escrow. To make a long story short, Thompson got very angry. Among other annoyances, he thought Frost was using him to punish Kay for refusing his marriage proposal. He lost what little objectivity he might still have had toward his subject and alluded in his notes to Frost's cruelty and Kay's double-crossing. What eventually happened was that Thompson died before the third and final volume of his Life of Frost could be published. It was completed by a man named Winnick, who had been Thompson's graduate assistant at Princeton. Winnick's solution to the problem of how to talk about Frost and Kay was to mention it in its early stages and then shift it to the background, which is unfortunate, given the fact that Kay Morrison was the poet's closest friend and the dominant influence on him for the last 24 years of his life. But back to the wildness of 1938. Frost once described, quote, "a vigorous devil in me that raises me above or drops me below the level of pity," end quote. This devil was very much in evidence at Breadloaf during the summer following his wife's death. A story often told there describes how, while Archibald MacLeish was reading his poems in the little theater at Breadloaf, Frost set some paper on fire to draw the audience's attention away from MacLeish, whom Frost considered to be full of himself and a second-rate poet. Later that night at Treeman Cottage, where the Breadloaf faculty retreated for drinks after the evening reading, MacLeish started reading from a new play he had written. Frost started making rude remarks and interrupting him, finally prompting the novelist Bernard DeVoto to shout, "You're a good poet, Robert, but you're a bad man." Frost also drank more that summer than was usual for him, and at one point he insisted that someone drive him to the far northern end of Vermont, where his daughter Irma and her husband were living. Then, when he didn't like the guest room that his daughter offered him, he insisted that he be driven all the way back to Breadloaf. He behaved, in short, like a spoiled child. But who would not pity a man who had lost his wife of 43 years, especially when he was America's best-loved poet? As Wallace Stegner reported some years later, Frost was obviously in deep distress that summer, and his behavior was part of the way in which his grief was manifested. Quote, "One knew that Eleanor had just died," Stegner said, "and felt pity. There was that halo of sadness on Frost. He had been singled out that year for particular anguish, and most of us understood this," end quote. In The Figure a Poem Makes, the preface Frost wrote for the volume of collected poems that he was working on during this chaotic period in his life, he says that a poem, quote, "begins in delight and ends in wisdom. The figure is the same as for love. It begins in delight. It inclines to the impulse. It assumes direction with the first line laid down. It runs a course of lucky events and ends in a clarification of life. Not necessarily a great clarification, but in a momentary stay against confusion," end quote. But then he goes on to say, "Then there is this wildness whereof it is spoken. It has an equal claim with sound to being a poem's better half. If it is a wild tune, it is a poem." In a letter to his close friend Sidney Cox in 1939, Frost made the connection between this essay and his feelings for Kay Morrison clear. He wrote, "One friend, my secretary, has taken me in hand to keep me lecturing and talking as of old, but I am very wild at heart sometimes, not at all confused, just wild, wild." Frost had plenty to be wild about in 1938 and in the years that followed. Even Lawrence Thompson, who has fallen out of favor with more recent Frost scholars because his dislike of the poet is so obvious, noticed it. He says in his notes from this period, "During the summer of 1939 in Ripton, and then during February of 1940 in Key West, Florida, I saw Frost come very close to the verge of insanity. He was a wild man. He was frantic. He was deeply upset. He was just plain crazy in some of his actions." How did this wildness manifest itself in his writing? Remember what he said in his preface, that wildness has an equal claim with sound to being a poem's better half. His sonnet, The Silken Tent, would certainly seem to bear this out. Although Frost gave the poem to Kay, his daughter Leslie insists that she remembers typing up a version of it for her father the winter before her mother died. It was Frost's habit to hang on to poems, sometimes for years, revising them periodically before including them in a published volume. So it is entirely possible that he wrote the poem initially with his wife in mind, but then gave it to Kay as a gift. In a letter to her in October of 1938, he said, "I have a weakness for you, but a strength from you. Surely no one could object to love that courses in the inflection of my sentences like impassioned blood in the veins." So let's take a look at that poem. The Silken Tent. She is as in a field a silken tent at midday, when a sunny summer breeze has dried the dew and all the ropes relent, so that in guise it gently sways at ease, and its supporting central cedar pole that is its pinnacle to heavenward and signifies the sureness of the soul seems to owe naught to any single cord, but strictly held by none is loosely bound by countless silken ties of love and thought to everything on earth the compass round, and only by one's going slightly taut in the capriciousness of summer air is of the slightest bondage made aware. The first thing to notice here is that the entire poem is a single sinuous sentence. We have the subject and the verb, she is, right up front. And what follows is an extended simile that begins with, as in a field a silken tent, and never looks back. There is something distinctly female and almost biblical about a silken tent, which at midday would be at its most light-filled and insubstantial, an impression that is reinforced by the S and Z sounds that weave their way through these opening lines. But remember that this is a simile, that she is like a silken tent at midday. In other words, she is in the prime of her life, her body full and swaying, at ease with her surroundings and seeming to move freely. But she is not all gossamer. She has a supporting central cedar pole, which signifies the sureness of her soul. Remember what Frost said in his letter to Kay Morrison, that he had a weakness for her, but a strength from her? And even though this central pole seems to owe naught to any single chord, we know, of course, that it is attached to the ground in many places by many different chords or guy wires. In metaphorical terms, these chords might be seen as the relationships that she has formed with those around her, the countless silken ties of love and thought that are a source of both strength and of obligation. Note, however, that these chords are not simply loose, but loosely bound. This would seem to support Leslie Frost's claim that the poem was written before her father fell in love with Kay, because what better image is there for marriage, where the partners are often bound to each other, but also have a certain amount of freedom? At the same time, it seems an apt description of Kay herself, who, for all her apparent freedom, was undeniably bound to her husband as well as to Frost. Frost presented this poem to Kay with a different title, In Praise of Your Poise. According to the Morrison's daughter, Anne, Kay was ecstatic when she read it, perhaps because she saw in its central conceit her own moral dilemma. But even if Frost did write the poem before falling in love with Kay, there is no question that his feelings for her were strong enough to justify such a tribute. In a letter to his close friend Louis Untermeyer in November 1938, he summed up her impact on his life this way. My secretary has soothed my spirit like music in her attendance on me and my affairs. It is an unusual friendship. I was thrust out into the desolateness of wondering about my past, whether it had not been too cruel to those I had dragged with me, and almost to cry out to heaven for a word of reassurance that was not given me in time. Then came this girl, stepping innocently into my days to give me something to think of, besides dark regrets. Because she'd had a number of opportunities to observe the Frost marriage before Eleanor's death, Kay surely knew how utterly dependent Frost was on his wife. In 1940, she wrote to Lawrence Thompson, saying that her only wish was to get Frost through this difficult period in his life without making him overly dependent upon her. In fact, Frost proved to be a difficult and demanding lover. He started out by insisting that she divorce her husband, which she steadfastly refused to do. And then, over the ensuing years, he would often become ill when he felt that she wasn't paying him enough attention. Although Frost was relatively circumspect in his written correspondence about Kay, he was often indiscreet in personal conversation, boasting about their sexual relationship and revealing things that made her uncomfortable. She told Frost's friends they should ignore literary gossip and never doubt that her first loyalty was to her husband and children. But it's entirely possible that she was sending mixed signals. On the one hand, she wanted to protect her reputation, especially in her children's eyes. On the other, she wanted to assure herself of her rightful place in the final chapters of Frost's biography. She was able to keep Frost, who was passionate, possessive, and jealous by nature, under control by reminding him that her marriage to Ted was a name only and that they were not intimate partners the way she and Frost were. For his part, Frost remained convinced that if he just gave her a little more time, Kay would eventually divorce Ted and marry him. By the summer of 1939 at Breadloaf, according to Lawrence Thompson, Frost was still, quote, in a wild state of confusion over Kay and eager to talk about it, end quote. It's interesting to note the similarities between his desperate courtship of Kay those first couple of years and what had happened with Eleanor more than four decades earlier, the summer after the two of them graduated from high school. In the words of one biographer, their intimacy was complete, and they had pledged themselves to each other before Eleanor went off to college at St. Lawrence University. But once there, she began to date other boys, one of whom wanted to marry her. Frost was consumed with jealousy and flooded her with letters begging her to marry him as soon as possible. But she insisted that she complete her education and that he find a reliable job first. This was after he had already dropped out of Dartmouth. Her practicality and aloofness drove Frost crazy, and in a typically melodramatic and attention-getting move, he took off for the Great Dismal Swamp on the border between Virginia and North Carolina to lose himself in his misery and to give Eleanor a good scare. Instead, he ended up getting lost and then running into some duck hunters who gave him a ride back to civilization in their well-equipped boat. Eleanor, meanwhile, kept right on studying for her exams. In October 1940, just as Kay had given Frost something to focus on besides grief and loss, tragedy struck again. His 38-year-old son, Carol, who, like his father, suffered from both respiratory illnesses and depression, had been running the family farm in South Shaftesbury, Vermont. Although it provided him with a free place to live and something to do, Carol didn't like being financially dependent on his father and found it impossible to earn a real living by farming. When Carol brought his family down to Florida to visit his father in 1939, Frost knew immediately that his son was in trouble. He was talking about becoming a poet. He even gave his father some of his poems and asked for feedback, which put Frost in an extremely awkward position. But seeing how much Carol seemed to like Florida, Frost bought some land in Coconut Grove and asked his son, who had carpentry skills, to supervise the building of two family houses there. But then Carol's wife, Lillian, had to have surgery for a tubal pregnancy, and her husband became so depressed that she was afraid to leave him home alone with their son, Prescott, who was 12 at the time. Frost left the Homer Noble farm in Ripton to talk to his son in South Shaftesbury, stayed for several days, and left, believing that Carol had pulled himself together, even though his last words to his father were, "You always win an argument, don't you?" The next day, Carol shot himself with a deer rifle, and it was his young son, Prescott, who found him in a pool of blood on the kitchen floor and called his grandfather. Coming as it did after the death of not only his wife, but his youngest daughter, Marjorie, who had died 4 years earlier of complications following childbirth, Carol's suicide dealt a crushing blow to Frost's spirit. In a letter to his friend Louis Untermeyer, he said, "I took the wrong way with Carol. I tried many ways, and every single one of them was wrong. He was splendid with animals and little children. If only the emphasis could have been put on those, he should have lived with horses." The year after Carol's death, Frost moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, which put him in close proximity to the Morrisons during those months when he wasn't living in Vermont and teaching at Breadloaf. Harvard appointed him a roving consultant in history and literature, another one of his many academic jobs that never involved much in the way of formal teaching duties. By this time, Frost and Kay seemed to have reached some kind of compromise whereby she would not become his wife, but would continue to act as his secretary and manage his correspondence and travel schedule. While there is some reason to doubt whether The Silken Tent was written exclusively for Kay, there is another poem that was clearly written with her in mind. Never again would birdsong be the same. He would declare and could himself believe that the birds there and all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning, but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as may be, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice, upon their voices crossed, had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would birdsong be the same, and to do that to birds was why she came. Frost's love of Shakespeare is clearly evident in the opening line with its echoes of Hamlet, "So have I heard and do in part believe it," which Frost once called the most beautiful single line of English verse. It is also interesting to note the conditional verbs he would declare and could himself believe, which cast a wishful light over everything that follows. The poem is a fantasy, really, one to which he is willingly surrendered, but which remains a fantasy nonetheless. The sonnet is set in the Garden of Eden, where the birds have been listening to the day-long voice of Eve, and as a result have added something of that voice, her tone of meaning but without the words, to their own song. Of course, they have had to make do with whatever opportunities have come their way to listen and to learn from her eloquence, waiting for call or laughter to carry her voice up to the treetops. Be that as may be, and this, along with the words admittedly, probably, and moreover, reminds us that the poem is pushing the envelope of credibility. She was in their song as surely as Kay Morrison was in Frost's life and in his poetry. And just as the bird's song has been changed forever, Frost seems to be saying he and his poems will never be the same. But the way he describes this intermingling of human language and nature's non-human sounds, her voice upon their voices crossed, applies as well to how the poet's voice both echoes and transforms that of Shakespeare in his love sonnets, adding to it an oversound that is uniquely American. I think the last line is one of the more curious ones, and to do that to birds was why she came. It's as if Frost sees Kay's arrival in his life as having been part of a larger design. He had lost his young son, Elliot, then his adult daughter, Marjorie, then his wife, then his son, Carol. To again quote that letter he wrote to Louis Untermeyer, "Then came this girl stepping innocently into my days." She was as much a gift as a necessity, and she stepped into Frost's life when he was at such a low point that he must have regarded her appearance as a form of divine intervention. The final line of this poem is as clear a statement as any about the way Kay transformed his life and inspired his work. Frost never really intended to keep his relationship with Kay secret. He was, after all, a widower, and in that sense, free. But he was also a great believer in marriage, and the fact that Kay was not only a married woman, but a woman with a husband who was both a boss and a colleague, if not quite a close friend, must have posed a considerable moral dilemma for him. How intimate Frost and Kay remained as he approached his 70s and 80s is not known with any certainty, especially since she destroyed most of the 500 letters he had written to her. His two most recent biographers, Jeffrey Myers and Jay Perini, take very different approaches to this period in Frost's life. Myers, whose book appeared in 1996, set out to blow the cover off Frost and Kay's affair by including as many lurid details as possible. Myers also makes frequent references to Kay's lack of inhibition and to the fact that Frost was not her only lover. According to Myers, Kay was also involved with three other men, one of whom was Lawrence Thompson himself, Frost's original biographer, who was 8 years her junior and apparently very attractive. But Thompson eventually married another woman, and the relationship with Kay faded. Remember what I said earlier about Thompson's fear that Kay would become Frost's literary executor? This did not happen, probably because Frost wanted the story of their long affair to eventually become public knowledge, and he knew that Kay would probably forbid that. After Thompson died prematurely in 1973, just 10 years after Frost died, and before the third volume of his biography was completed, Kay and Ted Morrison made sure that R.H. Winnick, who eventually completed the project, removed all references to her relationship with the poet. Jay Perini, whose biography was published in 1998, assures us that, quote, "The relationship between Frost and Kay appears to have slipped into the platonic realm rather quickly," end quote. Perini also defends Frost in his role as husband and father, ascribing much of his self-centeredness and insensitivity toward his family to his lifelong struggle with depression. I think the fact that opinions about Frost as a man, not as a poet, have swung so widely over the years is, if nothing else, a reflection of his complex personality. Many people have wondered how much Ted Morrison knew and why he put up with it. Almost everyone involved in this rather unusual arrangement had good reason to deceive him or herself. Kay told Frost that she and her husband were no longer intimate partners, but that for the sake of her two children, she would never leave him. And Frost was only too willing to seize on any evidence that Ted was cold and unfeeling. One can easily imagine Ted Morrison convincing himself that his wife was merely a secretary and helpmate to one of America's most famous poets, and lest we forget, one of his prized faculty members at Breadloaf, even though most of their meetings, at least in the summer, must have taken place in Frost's writing cabin, just a few hundred yards from the farmhouse where the Morrisons lived. Frost may have convinced himself that Kay would eventually leave her husband, but at some point he had to have realized this was not going to happen. As for Kay, who appears to have been in the driver's seat, if anyone was, surely she slept well, knowing that her husband was beside her and that America's favorite poet was being well cared for in his old age. And she did take care of him. In addition to typing up and editing his manuscripts, she answered his mail, scheduled his readings and lectures, paid his bills, read his proofs, made his travel arrangements, entertained his guests, furnished his houses and apartments, and drove him around. She was paid a decent salary for her efforts, but she was more or less on call all the time, and he would get very upset or come down with a psychosomatic illness when she was not available. When he was truly ill, she was truly there for him, as he was for her, especially in 1955 when her 24-year-old son, Bobby, was killed while changing a tire. There was more tragedy in store for Frost as well. After losing his wife to a heart attack, his son to suicide, and his daughter Marjorie to childbirth, he had to commit another daughter, Irma, to a state mental hospital. One of the more interesting comments on Kay Morrison that I've read came from Louise Reichert, a Ripton neighbor and a friend of Frost for many years. Here's what she said. "Kay Morrison was a planet, and these men circled around her, barely avoiding each other, her husband, Frost, Thompson, DeVoto, and others. She was beautiful but cold. The coldness was perversely attractive to them. She obviously had a way of connecting to them. She was witty and bright. The situation must have appealed to her, at least in some way." Cold or not, Kay's devotion saw Frost through the last 25 years of his life. She and her daughter Anne were with Frost on a daily basis when he was hospitalized in December 1962 for cystitis and an irregular heartbeat. During surgery, it was discovered that he had prostate cancer that had spread to his bladder, along with considerable damage to his heart. He was nearly killed by a pulmonary embolism on December 23rd, and he had another embolism on January 7th. A third embolism killed him on January 29th, 1963. Throughout this final cascade of medical crises, Kay Morrison was there, regulating the flow of visitors into and out of his room, helping him write notes to his friends, and making sure he was comfortable. And to do that to birds was why she came.
I'm Kate Dottrow. Thank you, Sue Ellen, for that very interesting presentation. I have a question about Eleanor. We don't know a lot about her. Has anyone written a biography, or is there any way we can find more information?
Well, all I know, and I think all most people know, is what they have read in the biographies of Frost. She did not have the kind of accomplishments in her life that lead people, you know, to be drawn to her as a subject for a biography. And maybe it's just a reflection of the time during which she lived, that she was very much in her husband's shadow. Very quiet, very reticent, skittish almost is the way I've heard her described. But the summer of 1998, when I lived in the Franconia, New Hampshire farmhouse where the Frosts lived for several years, and then after Eleanor died, Robert Frost went back there for many, many, many times. I worked at a desk that was directly opposite Eleanor's piano, and I thought about her constantly and of what a difficult life she must have had. I mean, all the tragedies he went through were her tragedies too. Thank you.
Hi, Sue Ellen. I'm Nancy Sakadusky. It was fascinating, a wonderful presentation, but I was fascinated by the silken tent and the fact that a poem seemingly as intimate as this could apply equally to his wife and his mistress. And I wondered if there were any other works of his or others for that matter where it's so unclear who is the inspiration for
the love
piece.
Object. Well, you know, I do think part of Frost's genius is that he doesn't make a poem. He doesn't reveal so much personal information that it can only be about one person or one thing. I mean, that is part of what makes his work so interesting, is we can often see ourselves in our own situations in his poems. So I think, I don't know whether I believe this poem was written when Eleanor was still alive or not. I kind of do, just because I'm inclined to believe what his daughter says. But I don't think it really matters. The poem is universal enough that it applies to both women.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I wondered if it could be that he got the same thing from both relationships.
Well, that's possible also, yes. They were both very supportive, very supportive.
I want to ask you about Frost's poetry and this period of his life. He almost borders on mental illness with the need that he has for Kay and the just the kind of egotistical and very, very needy person that you've described to us. How does it happen that this man has the capacity to write poetry that appeals to such a broad spectrum of people? I mean, he's the nation's poet. Mm-hmm. He's almost the English-speaking world's poet. And yet, the person you described really, again, as I say, bordering on mental illness.
Well, I do think there are many great writers who were not particularly nice people in their personal lives. I don't think that's that unusual. There was definitely, I mentioned the depression. The fact that one of his children committed suicide and the other one was committed to a state mental institution indicates that there could have been something genetic going on. But, you know, he died in 63. This was before antidepressants were available and before that kind of illness even had a name. But I do think for a lot of poets, their work is their escape from the personal. And it could be that he was able to achieve the rationality and control in his poems that he was not able to achieve in his life.
Well, also, he doesn't appear to be writing about himself. Mm-hmm. As well, he's got more, a broader a broader spectrum that he offers. And so to some sense, he's outside himself. Mm-hmm. But maybe you'd reflect on that for a minute, if there's any accuracy to my comment.
Well, we do have to remember, so he died in 63. This was when the confessional poets were just coming on the scene in America. It was not the style to reveal a lot of personal or taboo information in your poetry until people like Robert Lowell came along. So I think the poets he had studied, and even though he flunked out of two colleges and whatever, he was very, very much a self-educated guy with extensive background in Greek and Latin, which, you know, accounts for a lot of his facility with language. And I think the tradition in which he grew up was not a personal or confessional one. It was more of a universal truths kind of approach to poetry. And those were the poets he grew up reading.
Well, Sue Ellen, a wonderful lecture. And in it, your analysis of the silken tent is excellent. And I guess it could be any of the three, any of the three women in his life. But you drop kind of a real bombshell at the end when you offer the neighbor's description of Kay Morrison. And all of a sudden, we see another woman here, a woman that is needy in her own right, and that she's cold. And when I read The Silken Tent, actually, I think it could be about her, because I found the poem rather cold. And I'm asking, you know, where's the emotional content of this poem? And maybe I'm totally wrong, but maybe you'd reflect on that for a moment.
That is a very interesting comment. I think what you might be reacting to is the strictness of the form, the Shakespearean sonnet form, and that incredible concision and meter and all of that. I actually find this to be a very sensuous poem. And I think that is achieved largely through sound, which was very important to Frost, you know, all those S and Z sounds. But, you know, to be compared to a silken tent, I'd settle for that. you know, the sureness of the soul seems to own any single chord, strictly held, loosely bound. There are just so many sounds in there that I find the poem contained emotion, but emotion nonetheless, I would say.
Well, I certainly will not argue with the master here.
Good.
I'll tell you that. Sue Ellen, to close out the program, let me ask you to read one more poem by Frost. Let us leave the wild man, if you would, and take us back to that gentleman resting by his fireside.
An old man's winter night. All out of doors look darkly in at him through the thin frost almost in separate stars that gathers on the pane in empty rooms. What kept his eyes from giving back the gaze was the lamp tilted near them in his hand. What kept him from remembering what it was that brought him to that creaking room was age. He stood with barrels round him at a loss, and having scared the cellar under him in clomping here, he scared it once again in clomping off, and scared the outer night, which has its sounds familiar, like the roar of trees and crack of branches, common things, but nothing so like beating on a box. A light he was to no one but himself, where now he sat, concerned with he knew what, a quiet light, and then not even that. He consigned to the moon, such as she was, so late arising, to the broken moon as better than the sun in any case for such a charge, his snow upon the roof, his icicles along the wall to keep, and slept. The log that shifted with a jolt once in the stove disturbed him, and he shifted and eased his heavy breathing, but still slept. One aged man, one man, can't keep a house, a farm, a countryside, or if he can, it's thus he does it of a winter night.
Thank you, Sue Ellen, for a wonderful presentation. And a special thanks to our audience here in the Frederick Douglass Room. We appreciate your being here. Robert Frost, Wild Man, is the first in our series of four programs with Sue Ellen Thompson celebrating National Poetry Month. Please tune in next week when Sue Ellen will bring us Marriage, Metaphor, and Mortality, the poetry of Jane Kenyon. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.